I will speak briefly, and as the chairman had instructed, at least in time for questions. Among the many topics listed on your piece of paper describing the Maisa Bezin, the Yom Iyun, I'd like to focus on the next to the last one: how does Bezin avoid and or address cases of Aguna? But before doing so, and it's sort of an introduction to doing so, I'd like to again comment from experience on some of the remarks of my predecessors. Rav Shechter Shalita mentioned, and Rabbi Reis alluded to it, the statement of the Shach, as accepted and elaborated upon by the Chazon Ish, that although we paskin din HaTorah, when there are relationships entered into between parties, these relationships are sometimes governed within Dini HaTorah by what we call Minik HaSocharim, especially in cases in which a person is dealing with Jews and non-Jews alike, as in Rav Shechter's example, and therefore we don't assume that his mindset changes when one walks in, another walks in. We don't know who he's dealing with in so many cases. The unfortunate reality is not every Bezin is attuned to this nuance. I'm discussing now honest Batei Din. Then I was attuned to what I had a case in a Din Torah, which involved precise such a case. And I felt that the Dayanim, with whom I sat, who were both honest people, just didn't get it. They missed the main point. They're pooping back and forth with the erudition about what this, the Shach and the Ktzos and all this, said this has nothing to do with the case. Two people got involved in the deal. They do deals every single day. They're dealing with Jews and with non-Jews alike. I thought that we should have to find out what exactly is done in the industry, and that should govern, with all due respect, the Shach and the Ktzos would come down from Shemayin Denigri. Anyway, I was in effect outvoted, and I felt that the Psakdim was really not correct. It was a pshara, whatever that means, but I didn't think it was right. And one of the proofs that we like to bring to this Yisod of the Shach and the Chazon Ish is when individuals prepare papers and discuss how to go and get involved in a situation, with whom do they consult? Most people don't do things on their own. They consult. So they usually don't consult with rabbis, with Tohanim, with Batei Din. They consult with lawyers. That was exactly the case over here. You're not a lawyer. Lawyers don't know Dini HaTorah. So how are you going to say that if I have a lawyer, just think about it a minute, I have a lawyer to tell me everything I should do, but I expect that if there's a dispute, going to come to Dini HaTorah. So what am I a lawyer for? Should I have a Torah and a Rav? Just doesn't add up. So therefore, that's what I think. Unfortunately, I don't want to speak too much about this. There are also cases where the Bezin is not always completely honest. As Chazon Ish says, as Rav Shechter made a quick allusion, when it comes to honesty, this is a sine qua non. Whatever limitations we all have in our learning and in our experience and our other midos, but honesty has to exist. And therefore, I want to make a suggestion, which has been made before, perhaps not as utopian as it may sound. Our colleague Rabbi Blaise Shalita spoke and wrote some years back about his, what I call a utopian idea, which is the best in theory, of a national Bezin. A national Bezin to put out of business all the corrupt individuals. There'll be an understanding among the various people in the communities that there's only one Bezin. The Bezin will consist of different people from different points of view. But as long as they'll all be honest, I endorse the idea wholeheartedly. And I think that until the Mashiach comes, it's likely not to happen in this country. Halavai, but... So what do we do short of that? So we came up with a suggestion because you see there are interactions between our community and Batei Din of all different types and stripes in other communities. And sometimes an individual who is really the losing party and sometimes is even advocating a mild reprehensible position, I'm not discussing just purely monetary matters, will run and find a Bezdin in some location, which does not enjoy a reputation of honesty and integrity, and they'll just say, "Well, look, you have a bezin, I have a bezin." As I used to kibitz, "Vayomer Esav, Yesh Li Rav." I also have a Rav. So then you end up with a situation where it becomes so problematic till you get to the truth. So the suggestion was made that if we can't get the whole nation, the whole America, to agree on one Bezdin or one Bezdin system, let us within our own communities, however you want to define those communities, perhaps communities related to certain organizations that many people in this room have allegiance. I'm not discussing the yeshiva. It's not a yeshiva issue. It's more a congregational issue. And there are congregations. There's the OU congregations. There's the Young Israel congregations. There are rabbinical organizations, such as the Rabbinical Council of America, that if the individuals within this group will agree, and I'm speaking to Rabbanim and Eretz Yisrael about how firm this agreement has to be, how must it be arranged, is it enough that the various Rabbanim should agree, that the Balabatim should agree, every Balabas should agree, the President should agree? You can argue about this, and I'm sure people do argue about it. The Rabbanim and Mike, who I consulted with, including Rav Nissen Karelis and B'nai Brak and others, Rav Zalman Nechemia and Yerushalayim, they seem to have a very liberal view. So if the Rabbanim and, let's say, the presidents of all the Kehillahs will agree, then it's binding. That is the Bezdin. And you can no longer run to a different Bezdin. I want to go as far as Bezdin Kavua should be here. That's a little bit too much. But perhaps within this Kehillah, and it doesn't have to be geographically defined. It could be a shul here and a shul there, but they have some kind of a affiliation with one another. And if people sign in advance, this would be something which would be very desirable. Perhaps it's also utopian, but this is something we can work on. We try to work on this in the context of Aguna, as I'll come to in a minute, but even in terms of commercial disputes. Why is it that so often you find a case that individuals who are, well, I'll give you the case I was describing earlier. There were two, for the lack of a better term, Young Israel Balabatim. I don't mean to say that in any, I'm a rabbi of Young Israel myself. I don't mean it in any, there were two Young Israel Balabatim, clean-shaven individuals. I'm not degrading people who are clean shaven either. We have, you know, a very distinguished Manal the Bezdin. I'm saying they're coming from a certain orientation. Why is it that the party who I thought of the losing case ran to a Hasidic Bezdin in Borough Park? Now, if he was dishonest, we understand why he ran there. Okay, I'm giving the benefit of the doubt. I don't think so. I think the person was more or less honest, and that the litigant may have also been honest. He somehow felt, he intuited correctly, he'll get a better deal over there. Because he knows that if he comes to a Bezdin of who have a background in law or more on the outside world, they'll see right away what goes on, how all the other cases are adjudicated. And they'll say they're adjudicated in court and the Minhag HaSochem, so they'll go along. Whereas, as one rabbi told me in that particular case, what are you saying? You should follow the Minhag HaSochem, the law of the land, so the whole Choshen Mishmah is batal. Not true. That's a basic error. As we heard earlier from Rav Shechter Shlita, if we follow secular law and what you call torts and other things, then the choshen mishmah chas shalom be batal. But in interpersonal agreements, it's all what's in the head, and he used a lawyer, etc. So it would be a good idea. That's by way of introduction. I want to speak about what does the Bezdin do to avoid or address cases of aguna. So let's first talk about avoiding cases of aguna. How do you avoid a case of aguna? It's impossible. A man decides not to divorce his wife. And let's assume, by the way, I want to add something over here. Not every case of a woman who screams aguna, aguna, is really an aguna. Aguna is a case in which the man, by halacha, is required to give his wife a get. It's not always the case. Not always the case. If the man is halachically required to give a get now and doesn't do so, then the woman is called, in our terms, aguna. Okay, how do you avoid this in advance? A couple gets married, and there may be a falling out 10 years down the road, and and three rabbis will say, or whatever they may be, that he should give a get, and he won't listen. He says, who, mi samcha, who said you're the right rabbis, who said I have to listen to you, v'chule. So, what do you do? You'll say, force him to give a get. Everyone knows the famous Gemara, kol fonoso atchi yom erotzni, what's the problem? Well, in Satmar, they do it, they take lead pipes, well, they take a guy to a cemetery, and they tell him, we're throwing you in now, taking you out. Tomorrow, you know, you won't be pulled out of that grave. Now, the Bezdin of America is not engaged in these practices. Let me just first make a disclaimer. The unfortunate reality is that even if you're willing to do this, the get may not be a kosher get. Because unless it's a rare case with kfiyah, where compulsion is licensed by the halacha, very, very rare cases, it's called a get me'usa. Shalom Kedin. Getmus Shalom Kedin is possible or bottle. You're not doing the person any favor, really. Maybe it seems that way, but it's a very, very serious matter to be avoided at all costs. So what's there to be done? There really is very little to do. What can we do? If you cannot force someone to into a din Torah, for example, they won't come. So we can put some measure of communal pressure. Tamim and Al Yeshiva involved in an organization called Ora, which is trying to put pressure on the recalcitrant spouses, could be women or men. And as their efforts are deserve to be applauded. And this does have some effect on individuals who are subject to communal pressure. Some aren't, some aren't. Some love it. Spotlight, the limelight. Hey, they have cameras going in front of my house. I'm a kind of popular guy. My whole everybody ignored me. All of a sudden, I'm a gabra. So you're just playing into their sense of sometimes. Every case is different. So what to be done in these kinds of cases? Well, there are certain kinds of pressures that can be brought to bear. Things aside, just demonstrations, cases in which a person is banned from coming to shul. I just opened my insert and saw something I was unaware of before about a person, three people actually being banned from coming into a shul. It doesn't like sound like a perfectly great story on any end of the story. I don't know anything about it, but what I just read, and I want to add that papers are very frequently completely off the mark. No? Sometimes on purpose, sometimes by accident. They're just wrong. So I don't know. But what can be done? Well, we had a case in our own community of this nature. It goes back quite a number of years. Rabbonim and shuls are often put in the middle of these things. And unfortunately, well, I guess that's their job. That should be their job, perhaps. I should say it's fortunate when they do get involved, as I'll explain momentarily. It was a case of an individual, a fine man, a fine woman, very nice, but the marriage wasn't working out. And after years of counseling, I was involved myself in the counseling process, trying to see if we could work things out. The woman said, I can't go on with this marriage anymore. The man was very upset, and he said, if you don't do X, Y, and Z, I'm going to hold you a, quote, aguna. That was the word he used, aguna. So I was very unhappy with that word. Because, you know, until that time I lived a sort of a charmed existence in the Rabbonis. There were divorces, but they had nothing to do with me. They got divorced. No one ever came to me, why I'm not giving a divorce. This is my first case. And I had made a sort of a promise to myself, I'm not going to sit idly by. I said, you have to give the get. I think based on what I'm involved in, I'm the most involved in the case. I know the case. No, I'm going to hold her in a guna, rest such and such. What am I going to do? So the first thing he did was the most classical move. He ran to other rabbonim in town. That's it. You're not happy with your rabbi. He was in my shul. He was an officer in the shul. He davened in the shul. He wasn't happy with me. There are two other rabbis in town. No problem. We'll run to them. To their credit, two of my rabbinical colleagues in Riverdale heard the case from his mouth, not from hers, from his mouth, and both told him, based on your version of the story, we paskin, you have to give her a get. So that was that. Still back and forth, ahin aher. And finally we said that, you know, we're not getting anywhere with this guy. So we called him up, and we said to him, listen, mister, we like you very much, we're nothing against you personally, but since all three of us decided you have to give a get, primarily based on your own version of the story, we are declaring that you're not welcome in any of our shuls until you give her a get. If you come in, we're going to stop the services. Bomb. This is not done in every shul, in every community, but we did it. I felt it had to be done. So a few things happened as a result. First, he shied away. He didn't come. There was one little tiny private minion that no one ever went to, except for... So we said, let him stay there. The case had not finished with court yet. It was still going on in the court. Two things happened. One, he went to his friends in the shul, who came to me and said, Rabbi, what are you doing? What are you doing over here? He's not such a bad guy. I said, a bad guy? Who says he's a wonderful guy? But Rabbi, we ever heard of that? You have a lot of rabbis in New York. We never heard this done before. What's going on? You have authority? What is this? So I told him like this, you know, what you're saying to me is that you don't wish me to serve as an effective avbezin in the community. I give you three choices. I gave him three choices. I said, number one, you can convince him on your own to give a get. Number two, if you feel I'm not qualified, I give you permission to hire a different avbezin. I mean, I will, there has to be someone who's qualified. Could live in a base, a neighborhood. I don't care. Hire another Rav Bezdin. Let that Rav Bezdin handle the case. Number three, the third point is, if you're not going to accept A or B, then I'm the Rav Bezdin. But I will not accept anarchy. Balabatim didn't know what to do with themselves. They first tried to get the guy to get the guy. Of course, they failed. Another Rav Bezdin, that would be worse for them. So, since they did nothing, I took that to mean, and as I said in the public rush from the pulpit a year or two later, I'm the Rav Bezdin. Well, one guy was almost ready to walk out in protest. What's this rabbi? Megalomaniac. What's this? No, I gave him the choice. I gave him three choices, and that was the one that was left with. That was the first thing. The second thing that happened, of course, is the guy started losing in court, as would be expected. I got a call from one of those professional, Toein / Borer / Crook, Tzvos Lashon Achron, that says he was approached by this Mr. X, and that he wants to be the, of course he'll be the Borer, of course I'll be her Borer, and who should be the third? So I didn't say another word to him. And in my humble opinion, given this case, the fact that they both agreed to go to secular court in the first place, nothing to do with me, they didn't ask me, and now the guy's losing, he wants to go to a dintel with a crook. Even an honest guy, I don't know if he'd be allowed to go. Simcha Chavav is not so clear with a crook. As Rabbi Reis said, I think that Meikir within has no rights in the first place. You'd rather go to court. Someone else wants to go to a crook. This is one of the famous crooks. You know, I knew the name. So in any event, I fought off all the people who tried to get to the lady. And what happened? I went through court. Took a half a year. And the judge was well coached. Not by me. The judge said, it really should be 50-50 in terms of the assets, but because I know she wants a get, I'll give the man a bonus. If he gives his wife a get within a week, he'll get extra money. Now that's very critical. What judges usually do is they say, I'll give you a penalty if you won't give a get. That's already a get me'usa issue. A bonus. The get was given, and next Shabbos, the man walked into shul. So he walked into shul. I went over to the gabbai. I said, this man gets shlishi. I insist on it. So he says, Rabbi, I don't understand you. For 6 months, he was a persona non grata. You couldn't let him in. Now I get shlishi. So that's exactly the point. I never had anything against him. He just didn't give the get as the psak of the rabbanan. I gave it. He deserves shlishi. He deserves the shlishi. So he got shlishi. I ran up and I gave him a big ashikayach. Now I want to tell you something. I told a story over once, and it was a mixed audience, men and women, and a woman gets up, raises her hand in the back after I speak. Rabbi, you have a chutzpah. You gave this man shlishi. He's a no goodnik. That's how you reward people for 6 months of recalcitrance. I heard what was said. Okay. My response was, listen, I'm not here to give reward or punishment. I'm here to be a practical individual, a pragmatist, to get it done. You want to get it done, so you get it done. If you gave a guy an aliyah, he had no aliyah because he didn't give the get. Now he gets the get. What do you want? We should reveal. What do you want? We should ban it now. He deserves. Anyway, my Miskin and I can see everything from two sides. Okay. This is a case where the Aguna situation comes before you. However, I feel that the way to prevent it in the first place is through prenuptial agreements. Let me explain what this means in the short amount of time that I have. A prenuptial agreement is really has two parts to it. One is a document of arbitration. And I give credit to Rabbi Yechiel Per of the Masifta Yeshiva Far Rockaway, who wrote a shout-out to Rabbi Moshe about this many years ago. I got a response. A couple of different versions of the response, but that's not for now. In which Rabbi Moshe, of course, confirms that it's a good idea. And he does it. This means that, unfortunately, if a marriage breaks up, the first fight, as we heard from Rabbi Reis, is where are we going? Where are we going? Who's going to adjudicate? And often one party wants to go to secular court. Often the woman wants to go to secular court. She gets a better deal and then equitable distribution. But, of course, halachically, there's a rule that's not allowed. Why not allowed? We said before that the same thing would happen in a Beis Din. Okay. So you go to a Beis Din, tell the Beis Din they have to pass the equitable distribution. Do they? This is a matter of some dispute. My personal opinion is no, for the same reason I told you before. Generally speaking, when a person gets involved in business, he goes to a lawyer. And if he goes to a lawyer, it means he wants to be governed by secular law. When most people get married today, they go to a Rav. They go to a Rav, means they want to be governed by Torah law, as a rule. Do you have a right to be governed by New York State law of equitable distribution? The answer, as we heard from Rabbi Reis, is Yes, assuming that you say law as of the date of the marriage. Oh. Chafetz Chaim writes, in all relationships, the more you put out and set out forth in advance, the better off you are. So therefore, if you have a document of arbitration, it seemed to me the best thing to do was you're going to go to Bezin X, whoever it may be. We're not the Bezin of America's happening here. We're not the only Bezin in town. Bezin X. And we want, and the choice of law should be put in. If it's done in every single other contract that Rabbi Reese knows from his days as a lawyer, put in. We'll go to Bezin X, and they should pass them based upon Dinei HaTorah. They should pass them based upon New York law. Maybe California laws. It's 50-50, and that's it. Whatever you want to say. This seems to be advisable, because it just, based on Apir Chavetz Chaim, go back to the Chavetz Chaim and tell us, let's avoid so many disputes later on. Okay. It's very difficult to argue with such a prenuptial agreement. Nonetheless, despite the Tshuvas Igros Moshe, it just isn't done, except with the sole exception of Rabbi Peer. I don't know of any other Rav Rosh Yeshiva from that quote community that does this as a matter of course, a prenuptial agreement. To my knowledge, if I'm wrong, please raise your hand now and tell me that I'm wrong. I'd like to be corrected. Despite all the troubles that have existed in that world, terrible troubles. What can I do? In the prenuptial agreement, which I've been involved in now for over a decade, there's even more than that. You see, this agreement is very good, very nice. They come to the Bezdin, but the problem is, at the end of the day, it's difficult for a Bezdin to come to a decision which is going to give an incentive for the get to be given. Let me explain why in 1 minute. We're learning Ksubas this year. And there the discussions of the Ben Baal Ishto, there's a Chiv of Mizonos, there's a Chiv of support. Discuss at length in the middle of Masechta Ksubas. The husband has to support his wife as long as they're halachically married. That's the biggest incentive. She just go to Bezin. The Bezin should say, well, support her, and that'll be the end of it. There are two issues. One, what does support mean? He'll say, I'll support her $1 a day. Okay. Number two, support her? Of course. The Shulchan Aruch says, she'll support her. But that's only if we're living together in the same house. If we split, then it's clear in Shulchan Aruch. As clear as day. What's the dinner? What's so clear? Depends whose fault it is. If it's his fault, then he has to support her. If it's her fault, not. Now go passing up that one. And in the middle, meanwhile, say, I'm also mechaveh, all right? So it's the end. It's the end. So all that this prenuptial wants to do is do two things. Number one, gives an X amount of dollars. This already goes back to the Nachla Shiva, goes back to Takana Shum. It goes back a long time. I was at a wedding last night, so the rabbi didn't know what he was reading, but he read the old style Tznoim, Takanas, and he stopped and he stalled. I didn't know Shin Vav Mem. He finally realized it must be just Shum, which it is. Shpai Rav Armaiza Magensa, we learned about an Ashir recently, in a different context. That's where they had this Takana to give X dollars per day. Number two, it says that the obligation exists in all cases, no matter, irrespective of fault. And the way out is for the man to come to the Beis Din, summon her to the Beis Din, and if she doesn't listen to what the Beis Din says, if she doesn't appear, then he's off the hook. All this does is just put the shoe on the other foot. That's all it does. This way, the status quo is he has to pay X dollars a day, let's say $100 a day, for example, which is what's needed to support a woman. And if he doesn't pay her, then he could be in contempt of court for not paying. The third advantage of this is it's done in legalese. Legally binding. And therefore, it has an impact. What's the impact? Has it ever been tested in court? No, that's exactly the impact. We've had many cases where a person would otherwise be recalcitrant, but isn't because of disagreement. That's why I recommend it very strongly. I'll end with one final point. If you're getting married, or if you serve as a rav ultimately and are doing it for others, don't wait till the last minute. This is done, I'm telling you from experience, it's always wait, it's uncomfortable, it's not nice. Don't wait for the last minute. Rabbi Reese and I had to fend off the following case. I'll end with this. A prenup was signed at the chuppah, at the chassan's tish. A rabbi who was an attorney gave a chassan a prenup. What's this? He's explained it. I do as the matter of course. Signed his name. Broke up. The marriage broke up rather quickly. And the guy was stuck because he had a prenup. So one of his Brooklyn gets involved again full time, and they had a guy from Brooklyn call me up and harangue me. This is null and void. It's null and void. Why null and void? Well, I say it's null and void. He said, but they signed the Shtar Birurim to go to the Besdin of America. Oh, we said it's null and void. So I said to the guy, do you know what the word Shtar Birurim mentioned before? No? The document of arbitration. Besdin won't hear a case without a document of arbitration. Every Besdin. So I said to the guy, whenever anyone goes to sign the Shtar Birurim to your Besdin, I'll say it's null and void. Every Besdin can just say everyone is under the Shtar Birurim, it's null and void. Nuts. Well, here's the answer. In principle, the answer is yes, you can, in principle. In reality, it's not done, because it's But this, but every rule has exceptions. Well, this is an unusual case. He didn't know what he was doing. We never saw this piece of paper kind of before. They're not used to it. So we're going to rule that your Shtar Birurim is null and void. We said, we're the only ones who can judge whether it's null and void or not. The guy says he didn't know. Come to our Besdin and tell us, and we'll decide. Back and forth. It was touch and go. At the end, the person caved in. And you know why he caved in? I'll tell you why he caved in. Not that I know it's a matter of fact, my speculation, because his lawyer told him to cave in. His lawyer told him, whatever they're saying to you in Brooklyn, if it goes to court in New Jersey, it's going to be upheld. And therefore, you just give in and give a get, settle it, and that's what happened. That's what happened. But why should you be in a situation, you know, some better people will be upset anyway, but there was a bit of a case over here. Again, the last minute, it wasn't focused. It was a quote, Taina. Now you look at the end of Siman Samech Vav and Ebenezer, it says if a person says he didn't know what he was signing, we don't believe him. But there could be, you know, you can argue on that in certain cases. So therefore it should be done far in advance. I'm supposed to leave time for questions. I left about 30 seconds. I thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you very much. This is my Phil Donahue impression. I would like to pose the first question, and then hopefully a student will agree to take the microphone around. We'll take another three questions. Can either of the honorable rabbis give us examples of where the Beit Din has dealt with situations between either educators and their schools or rabbis in their congregations? These are future professional rabbanim, mechanchim, and I'm sure they're curious about such cases that might have come before the Beit Din.
One of the most traditional realms of Beis Din, even in times when people weren't going to Beis Din so much to adjudicate commercial disputes, was to take care of disputes that are very much within Jewish organizations. So for example, if there'd be a fight between a rabbi and a shul, or between an administrator and a yeshiva, this was always a much more traditional case that would somehow end up in Beis Din. Everyone, even if they didn't understand the halachos, if they had a dispute over a contract, people understood that in these cases they would go to Beis Din. So even today, when we deal with other disputes, part of the bread and butter of our practice, shall I say, involves disputes of this sort as well. One of the first cases that I dealt with when I joined the Beis Din of America involved a rabbi who had been released from his duties in a shul after about 25 years of work. And there was a dispute between the rabbi and the shul over what an appropriate amount of severance should be. Not over reinstatement. I think he accepted that he didn't really want to be there if they didn't want him. But there was a dispute over the proper severance pay. And the shul originally said that they would only submit to a zabla. And then in the end, they chose a toein. But when we tried to get in touch with a boer, but this boer was kind of like a toin, and when we dealt with him, he was very difficult, and finally came to the conclusion that he wasn't going to cooperate at all. So this was one of the cases where we actually had to issue a shtar seruf. We actually had to threaten the shul that if they didn't appear properly before Din Torah, at least a zabla, either before the Beis Din or before a mutually acceptable Beis Din, then we would have to issue a seruf. So we issued a declaration of contempt against the shul, and they had trouble after that. The it's a division of communal services, a YU would not give them a YU musmach because they were subject to the Seiruv. So every now and then, over the years, I would get a call from somebody who was new in the congregation, either somebody who became a rabbi from a freelancing rabbi or a new president who didn't want the Seiruv anymore. Usually it was the president because they didn't want the rabbi they had. They wanted a better rabbi. And he would ask, what do we have to do to get the Seiruv removed? So I would say, try to settle with the rabbi or else submit to the Din Torah. I've had this conversation with this shul probably 3 or 4 times over the last 3 years. And as far as I know, nothing's been resolved yet. But that's one of the cases that we dealt with. And another case also, shortly after I started my tenure, involved a shul that was disbanding. And there was a dispute between the rabbi and the shul over whether the shul had the right to terminate the rabbi altogether. They wanted to get rid of the rabbi. The shul didn't really have much of a minion anymore. The rabbi didn't even live there. He didn't really show up too much, but he wanted to still be rabbi of the shul, and he contended that they just wanted to get rid of him so he wouldn't be in the picture when they would sell all the assets, and they wanted to divide all the assets amongst themselves. So that was an interesting case as well. And that actually went to a Din Torah at the Beis Din of America, and we had a panel of Dayanim. I don't remember who all the Dayanim were, but I think at least one of them was a Rosh Yeshiva here at YU. And we adjudicated that case as well. And it's not unusual. Many of the cases that come to Beis Din involve all kinds of employer-employee type situations where somebody loses a job, and they're more likely at that point to want to go to a Beis Din to court anything because they're out of a job and they need money. So an employee is likely to bring a case against his former employer for severance or for unpaid wages or something like that simply because there's more monetary stress in the person's life. So we've had a number of cases of teachers or administrators of yeshivas who were released from their duties or their contract wasn't renewed. And they brought cases at the Beis Din, and the Beis Din has dealt with them. And one of the there are many interesting issues that have to be dealt with. When is severance appropriate or not? There's a common understanding in the Torah community, or a common impression, that there's this concept of Chodesh Lashono, that if you work for a Torah institution, one of the members of the Beis Din, Rabbi Boy, just wrote a piece on this issue, wrote an article on this issue, of is there a custom in all Jewish institutions that if somebody works for that institution, they're automatically entitled to Chodesh Lashono. So that's when. What if there were payments made in addition to the person's salary while they were there? Does that count against Chodesh Lashona? Is the person automatically entitled to Chodesh Lashona? In every single, is it different based on prior practice in every single shul and every single institution? So those are some of the issues. And of course, one of the other issues is: do you have a right to terminate a rav? Do you have a right to terminate or not to renew the contract of a rav or a rosh yeshiva? A famous Shuva by Rav Moshe, which he indicates not so, but some have the minog that they don't necessarily renew contracts, so is the minog binding in this case? Whenever we have a Din Torah like this, where someone wants reinstatement, they always come in and they quote Rav Moshe, and that's also a recurring theme of the Dinei Torah.
Just a technical question, I guess for people from the Beis Din. Approximately how many Dayanim work in the Beis Din, and is it the same Dayanim who are constantly dealing with the cases? And before you get to Zeborah, so if people come in with a Din Torah, so are they assigned a Beis Din and they have to decide whether they want it or not? Exactly how does the Beis Din deal with that issue?
If a person chooses an institutional Beis Din, say like Beis Din of America or Machon Lahayra or Kolol HaRabbanim, then they're agreeing to accept the dayanim that are appointed by that organization. That being said, we have, if you look, I think that in your materials, you have a copy of the rules and procedures of the Beis Din. I think it's Section 6. If you look in Section 6, the Beis Din of America allows a party, once they're notified who the dayanim will be, we notify them in advance. We don't wait till the last day. We give them the opportunity to strike a dayan or say that they think that a particular dayan is not appropriate because he's disqualified as a matter of halacha. To be disqualified as a matter of halacha, a dayan has to have a bias, he has to have a negia, has to be an oev or a sone. There has to be some demonstration that this dayan is possible as a matter of halacha. As a general rule, most dayanim, if there's any kind of reasonable objection made, will recuse themselves if one of the parties thinks that it's inappropriate for that dayan to sit there. Obviously, if a party just keeps on striking all the dayanim, after a while, that shows that they're not really submitting to the Din Torah, so you can't allow that to happen either if there isn't a reasonable ground for objection. If it's a Zabla, then the way that a Zabla works is that each party chooses a Dayan, assuming that those two Dayanim are Ksherim, the two Dayanim themselves pick the third Dayan. It's not the Bali Din who pick the third Dayan, this is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, it's the two Dayanim who pick the two Bararim who pick the third Dayan.
I apologize if this has been discussed, but in terms of when determining if a case is one Jew against another Jew, how does the Bezdin determine by cooperation, even if it's just a mom-and-pop organization which has been incorporated by any state? Does the Bezdin view look at the shareholders, the board members, the officers, or directly who the suit is against?
We assume that a Jewish corporation has a status like a Jew in Hilchas Ribbis. We say that a shul or yeshiva is not permitted to take Ribbis deraisa, even though the Rashba and the Tshuva writes is what the Dingzach. But that's the practice. I would assume over here also, if it's a Jewish corporation, even though you have they've incorporated, but we would treat it like a Jewish individual, so we wouldn't insist that they have to go to a Din Torah. They can't go to secular court. I would assume so.
This is about what Rav Schechter quoted from the Teumim, about how if you ask the person three times and they refuse to come to Beis Din, so you can take them to secular court. The Teumim says if you ask them once and they're totally mevaza the idea of going to Beis Din, so then you can take them to secular court after just asking them once. The question is, what if, can you make an umdana if a person's totally not religious, or a person you know is mevaza bati dinim before Hesse, even if he does go to a young Israel or whatever, would you be allowed to take the person to secular court without even having to ask them once?
I didn't actually quote what the Tumim said. The Tumim talks about your case.
Oh.
He talks about, I was talking about our practice, that we call on the telephone and we save ourselves the third Hazmanah. Tumim talks about a case, I know the fellow, everybody knows him in the neighborhood. So he says you don't have to have any Hazmanas. But that's a little risky to do that, because sometimes the fellow, even if he's anti-religious, will agree to go to a Din Torah. Well, why should he think that Din Torah is going to be worse than a secular court? In such a case, what you do is you send a registered note, send a registered letter, and you send him a three registered letter. It costs $3 instead of $1.
Is there any way in which the Beis Din tries to have everybody deciding similarly, as you were saying, I think secular law is an idea of case law, and once something is decided a certain way, it's continually decided a certain way. Or does each Beis Din have the ability to analyze Chosha Mishpat on their own?
That's an excellent question. Within a particular system, there's a tendency to try to be consistent. For example, the most extensive system in our time, by far, is the system in Eretz Yisrael. And there is what they call the Piske Din Rabbanim, the Padar, that many volumes have come out, where some attempts at consistency have been made. Nonetheless, even there, you find that every Dayan maintains his own independence. And you find, not only within a Beis Din, could it be two against one, but there could be five cases, three against none in a particular case, and another Beis Din says they're all wrong. So you go to the Beis Din to whom you go, and they have the certainly the right to be independent, to make whatever decision they do. Nonetheless, to establish a certain measure of confidence in the community at large, people see what happens, and they draw conclusions. Now, we've been in the Beis Din of America. I'm speaking again, as I spoke earlier, about Taguna cases. We had some rough and tough cases of people, we're dealing with rough and tough lawyers. And they came, Jewish lawyers, non-Jewish lawyers. There's no monopoly on roughness and toughness. And they came to our Beis Din. and they heard what we had to say. Often both complain. That's often a sign you got it right. And it's very important that a dayan recognize that despite the ideal to which Rabbi Reis referred to in his concluding remarks about emes and din and shalom, everyone should walk out happy. If both parties walk out unhappy, it's also not so bad. It means that they wanted everything, they got something, and it's likely that that really is the emes and the din. So therefore, we try to be consistent within our own, but in our Beznev Emek, we try to be consistent. But nonetheless, there are independent dayanim, and we don't take away their independence in any given case.
I want to again thank Rav Willig, Rabbi Reis, for their words today, and thank you for being active and asking questions. We're going to break now for lunch. On behalf of Dr. Lamb, I want to say that he is sorry that he can't be here. I take full responsibility for that. It was my scheduling error, so he regrets that and is unfortunately unavailable to speak to us at lunch today. So we have lunch available for you. At the conclusion of lunch, we will bench. There will be, while we're still sitting there, a short presentation by the current president of the Beit Din of America, the lay leader, as opposed to the professional or the Av Beit Din, the Skan Beit Din. And then we will break up into our smaller groups. So please join us for lunch. There's a washing station in the back, and I believe there's a second mobile one over